This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 4, Episode 2. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com. You can email us on
coach@pitchvision.com.
And you can call us on
0208 816 7691.
My name is David Hinchliffe, and this week I'm joined by Mark Garraway. Well, welcome along to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. Here we are again, Garraz and myself holding the fort while Berners is traversing the United Kingdom today, doing all sorts of crazy things. So, Garraz, yes, it's a head-to-head this week.
Well, it's a shame not to have Berners here. I actually went to a function yesterday where somebody was talking to me about listening to the programme, and he questioned what on earth Berners does, because he's always somewhere other than where we want him to be.
I like to think of Berners as the sorbet of the meal of the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. He clears the palate somewhat.
I think that's a lovely analogy, mate.
Yeah. So let's talk about cricket. There's been some talk around the sizes of squads in international cricket this year. Harsha Bogle has been talking about it on Crick Info, and he's been saying, the Indian squads are too big. And I thought that was an interesting area to talk about, because squads is something that happens at pretty much every level, apart from perhaps at club level, where the squad is not always a problem, but certainly at representative level, you're thinking about picking squads and the size of the squad that you go for. So what's your thinking around the sizes of squads at any level?
Well, I think you've got to look at your competition programme first and foremost to see how onerous that is. And one of the reasons for international squads getting bigger is the rotation policy that, particularly around the bowlers, the international teams are placing, because the workloads and the lack of recovery time in between games and series is putting a huge amount of stress on those guys. So hence, at international level, with the programmes being so thorough and so regular, squads have to be a bit bigger. So I can understand it. I don't think anybody's quite got it right yet, because it's quite new for people to look at rotation, and there's arguments for and against that in terms of form and creating a rhythm that you get into as a bowler or as a batter. But I think over the next few years, you'll find that some sides will do enough research and monitor their players well enough that they get that better. At club level and going down the ranks, again, it's dependent on the competition programme. And if you've got a limited programme, then I think it's a bit unfair to have two larger squads, because you don't give people the opportunity to impress or to improve. And certainly, for example, at our school level, we run with a 13-man squad. We narrow that down at Easter ahead of our season. We take 15 on a pre-season tour, and then when we come back on that tour, we narrow it down to 13. That means that those 13 get the first chance to perform and stay in the side. And then obviously performances between second team and the first team performers, if somebody's having a bit of a rough time, then a chance to go down into the second team and build up some confidence while somebody who's done well comes up is the normal way of going at things. So we play about 20 fixtures in a year, and because of that, a 13-man squad with a little bit of rotation in and out based on form or injury comes into play, but no more than that.
Yeah, and I'm getting an experience of dealing with squads at the moment with working at regional level, and one of the things you have to take into account when you're talking about that type of cricket is that you want to make sure that the players are getting their chance to have a game, because the parents are paying a not inconsiderable amount of money to have their talented kids in as part of that setup. So what you don't want to be doing is having a kid who doesn't bat or bowl and feel, especially at the younger age group level, he might be fielding for a 35 over or a 40 over match, and he doesn't get his turn to have a bat or a bowl, and then because there's so many players in the squad, he only gets a couple of chances for the entire season. So you have to consider that at the lower levels as well.
No, I completely agree. And what we try and do here at school, I know it's replicated amongst clubs as well, so it's not a new thing at all, is to have different levels of competition and different levels of challenge placed in front of any given team. So for example, here we have some development games where we're able to put some number nines and tens who are all good batters, but don't get the opportunity because we've got quite a strong batting unit to bat up the order in certain games, you know, the ones that aren't competition based. And this is one of the things that I think club cricket needs to consider a bit, because it's become a bit of a fad to have Sunday leagues in club cricket. And what that does is it means that generally the same people that open the batting on a Saturday game in the leagues and in the cup competitions, the big competitions, then also do that on a Sunday. And I think in terms of development of cricketers, the old days when I sort of started growing up, where we had friendly cricket, which was obviously very competitive because that's the way you play your cricket, but it gave opportunity for us to move the orders up and about and give other people an opportunity to bowl, particularly the youngsters. And that made a huge difference in my development as a cricketer and a number of the guys around me. And I sometimes think that the sort of notion of having competitive cricket all of the time takes away that opportunity for somebody, a late developer or somebody with a new skill, to develop that properly.
I also had my my first session with the under-11s, regional under-11s.
Cool, how'd that go?
Yeah, that was really good fun. They are all very keen, as you can imagine, at that age, and with a little bit of talent behind them. They're all super keen to be doing some exciting stuff. We didn't have a lot of space. It's only a small little hall that we're doing it in, but we did some work on running between the wickets, and we got their sweat on because it was pretty cold at the weekend. So we got their sweat on and they enjoyed it. It's the first time as well that I've ever worked with an assistant coach who has been and still is a lead coach in age group cricket in a different age group. So it's quite interesting to work with him being officially the head coach, but then, you know, he was sort of head coach number two. You know, he couldn't help himself.
Absolutely. And you find that, don't you? When you start working in those areas, everybody's got an experience where they have led, and you know, over time the relationship builds that you almost end up taking it in turns to do that lead role, and that will develop over the weeks, I'm sure.
Yeah, and he's a great guy, and we have a good working relationship, so it wasn't a problem. But it was interesting, that dynamic of having two people doing the job, and you know, I was pleased with some talented kids, and they pick things up quickly, and fingers crossed we'll have everything in place for the start of the season. We've still got a way to go yet, but I'm very pleased. We've got to find a wicketkeeper though, Gareth. That's our big problem.
Oh mate, they're out there. You just got to know what to look for, and you'd be there. They'll stand out. Somebody will stand out. And I think at that age, it's not important to specialise. I mean, I didn't start keeping wicket till I was 15, actually.
Right.
Or 14. And I found myself, through circumstance and luck as much as anything else, I found myself keeping wicket for England about 9 weeks after I started doing it. And I think it's a really important thing. You look at Alan Knott, who was one of the greatest. He started off as a leg spin bowler and actually got onto a contract at Kent, partly due to his leg spin. So, you know, somebody will pop their head up. They might not end up being that wicketkeeper at under-19s, and I'm not bothered whether they're specialist keepers at that age as well, because you just never know. But somebody who maybe isn't getting a go that you like as a batter, who's got a good pair of hands, it could be an area that you could encourage them to go into and see whether they like it. And I'm sure they'd do a good job.
Yes, well, we'll have a little go at that. Maybe we'll have a full session on wicketkeeping and find someone who's got a nice pair of hands who can do the job for us in the coming summer.
Well, it's not a bad idea anyway, because it gives the others that maybe aren't wicketkeepers or got no interest a bit of an appreciation of another skill. And I don't think that's ever a bad thing. It broadens their awareness, but also might give them a skill which is transferable into their fielding. So I think that's a great idea.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many points of wicketkeeping, aren't there, that are applicable to fielding in other areas, you know, hand-eye coordination and getting into a good position and hand positions and things like that. It's all good stuff.
Well, actually, the guy I was talking to yesterday, and I'll give a shout out to Bucko, who will be listening to this. But he started off as a fielder, and because he was athletic, they stuck him behind the stumps at my club, and he did that for a number of years, and then turned himself into an opening batter because he was very physically competent And knew when to run off a fifth or sixth ball when he was opening the batting with my dad, which was a good thing for my dad's rhythm in his batting. And then he went to fielding again when some of the younger guys, including myself, started to keep wicket. He said that it was more important for those guys to do the job, and he fielded again. And obviously the transferable skills that he took from his keeping made him an incredible catcher in the outfield as well. So absolutely right. I think there's some really good transferable skill stuff that can be done, even if somebody's got no intention of keeping wicket later in their career.
Well, I'll keep everyone listening posted on what's happening with my regional cricket coaching, because I think it's good to hear what's happening in the real world of cricket coaching, and also it's good for me, because self-reflection is one of those things that I don't really do enough. So it's good just to talk about it out into the ether and get those things that are buzzing around my head into actual words.
No, very good, mate. I agree. We could all do with being a bit more reflective and all of that sort of stuff. So I like that.
Okay, let's go on to the yes-no round, which is, of course, three questions that only Gareth and myself can answer yes or no to. And although Berners isn't here, we have recorded him asking the question. So we've got him from sometime in the future recording these questions in the yes-no round. So, Berners, over to you for the yes-no round questions.
Hi, folks. First question, yes-no round. Let's do it. Even Dhoni can't maintain captain, wicketkeeper and main batsman roles.
Yes.
Yes.
Second question. The easiest skill set to learn adequately is wicketkeeping.
No.
Yes.
Third question. Always play a spinner.
Yes.
Yes. And now coming up on the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, we've got an interview. We're joined by Stephen Jones, who is a former professional fast bowler and professional rugby player. The last one, we think, to ever do both of those. And he's now doing strength and conditioning for a range of different people, from professional players down to schoolboys. And he's launched a course, an online training course, which is available now on Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And it's called Get Wheels. So it's all about getting strong and building up your pace for being a fast bowler in the gym and beyond. So as part of that course, we recorded an interview with Steph. And you can listen to a portion of that now. So let's head over to that interview.
Let's move on to that main part of the workout. Shall we start with medicine balls?
Yeah.
Well, how do you see? Where do you see the role of medicine balls in training for speed?
Okay. I actually get quite angry with the fact that it is now. You know, they're out there now. The cricketers start throwing the medicine balls out, and they see them coming out. Tea time, lunchtime, throwing the medicine ball. But you know what? They should have been around for 20 years. That's the medicine ball is your best friend. That has to be the best friend. What medicine balls to me is, it's the bridge between gym strength and game strength. That's the bridge. You can't train, get massive on the bench in here. I can bench 100 kilograms. And then you go and bowl and you're like, well, I'm actually bowling backwards again. But because you've not transferred that gym strength into game ready, and that is the bridge. For me, it follows a simple pattern. You get strong in the gym. You have a phase of getting strong, big, powerful in the gym. Then you throw the medicine ball, you bowl a heavy ball, and then you bowl. That's the simple pattern, and I can guarantee you there's only one thing you're going to do, and that's bowl quicker. But you can't go from the gym, walk out and pretend to bowl like Brett Lee, because it's not happening. Because you've not transferred those gains into specific gains. And medicine ball does it. And same with plyometrics, it's a ballistic. So it's a ballistic medicine ball throw, and jumps are ballistic. So it's really explosive by nature, you know. You can have a phase of Olympic lifts before then, but you know, if your technique is not great with Olympic lifts, you know, don't do them. You know, I'm not spending 2 years teaching you how to do an Olympic lift where we can get the same training effect as by doing trap bar jump squats or tire flips or granny throws, just training the triple extension. So you get the same training effect, but because some character's told you to do Olympic lift, doesn't mean it's right or wrong. If you haven't got the technique to do it, at the end of the day, it's a skill. An Olympic lift is a skill. And I'm not training to be good at Rio. I'm training someone to bowl quickly. I'm not at bowling. I can tell you what, the gold medalist in London won't be able to bowl an outswinger because it's a skill, okay? So that's why it's not one size fits all, but that size should include a medicine ball.
Why does, talk about weighted balls now, why do weighted balls work?
Because it's skill specific. In Westside, they would call it special strength. So it's really specific to your sport. And it's not about doing cable bowls or standing on a Swiss ball, doing a power clean with stability and doing those circus acts. It's about doing the skill, but with overload, just overloading the skill. So, you know, there's research out there that says you only 10-20% of added weight on the ball, but then that's only going to take you to what, 180-190 grams balls. But that's not enough of a contrast for me. You know, you pick a 190-gram ball and you bowl a normal ball, it's like, well, that's hardly any different. But if you pick a 300-gram ball and then bowl a normal ball, that's a massive contrast. So it needs to contrast, needs to feel differently to a normal ball. So, but not too heavy to affect the mechanics. But saying that, I would bowl for 20 minutes, okay, with a weighted ball. But that's hardly anything compared to the amount of balls I'm going to bowl in the nets and in the game. So is it going to adversely affect my technique? I don't think so. But I'm on my own on that one, I think. The amount of volume you bowl with a normal cricket ball is a lot more than you would with a weighted cricket ball in a training session. But the training effect you get from a weighted ball is massive, massive. So it would be, okay, an arm speed session, I call it, would be, okay, I'm going to bowl, bowling it over, I'm going to bowl two balls with a 300-gram ball, I bowl it. Nice rest in between. Then I bowl a cricket ball, normal weighted ball, two balls. And then I bowl two balls with a tennis ball. So then it's over speed. And then you go around that in a complex then, like that. It's just about tricking your nervous system. Like the first bit is an overload, heavier, and the last bit is speed. Your arm speed is going over quicker, so your brain thinks, well, that's how much force, that's how much power, that's how much arm speed you have to do for a normal cricket ball, in layman's terms.
Now it's time for us to answer your questions on the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. And of course, every week, best question wins a prize, which is an online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So we have two questions this week. And yet again, Berners is going to appear from the ether to read out those questions. So Berners, over to you for the questions.
So on to the question round. Our first question comes in from Sagar, and he's asking, how does statistical information, including shot direction, bowling angle, line length, etc., help a batsman improve his game? He recently talked to a very good batsman himself who ignores this, saying he knows the shots that he's played and for which type of bowling he played them against and which bowler against. Also the line and length which he executed these shots. So he basically knows his strength and weakness. So does he actually need these stats?
Now, I'm very interested in your view on this, Gareth.
There are people who prefer statistics, which helps them to build a picture in their head, which then enables them to be able to put emotion into place. And there are people that if you give them stats, it will confuse And it sounds like this person may have had some experience of being confused before, and hence has gone with their preference, which is to go without it. Mm-hmm. And it's, I mean, it's a very complex thing in the way that our bodies and our minds work, because, you know, there are different ways, and actually four ways in which they can all work. But as a general rule, 50%, around 50% of the population will prefer that type of information and will be able to use it in a constructive way. And 50% of them will find it either confusing or will just ignore it because they don't think that it will impact upon performance. So there's no hard and fast rule. I think the skill of any analyst or any coach using data and using statistics is to understand what their population within their group is, and then to apply their information appropriately with the people that it's going to maximize performance with, and to make sure that any messages that go into the guys that don't like statistics are very clear, but not necessarily, they might be based on stats, but not really referring to stats. And that was really the skill that I know that Nathan Lemon, who does the England side's analysis, and DJ, who does the Indian team's analysis, those are the skills that those guys, like myself when I did it, had. You get to learn about your group and you apply your information according to that person. And ultimately the group that you have, by doing a lot of watching, observation, but also some psychometric stuff. But you can pick up those things. You know, if somebody turns their nose up at something, it's generally a good body language to say they're not interested in stats, and then you apply a different way.
Yeah. So what you're really saying there is that that the stats can still be there, they can still be around, but some people, if you know, you can hand them a spreadsheet almost, and they will lap it up. And other people, you have that spreadsheet, but you go to them and you say, "Oh, I've just noticed that you're doing this when the ball's outside off stump. Have you thought about doing that instead?"
Yeah, absolutely right. So somebody like Matthew Hoggard, for example, I would give him all the information and none of my views or none of my conclusions based on the information. And then he would come to me and he would tell me what he'd found out from that information. So I'd just give him flat data and he'd come back to me with the answer, because I knew that the way that he operated and knew what he'd come back with. And then we'd have a discussion based on what his observations were against what mine were. And we'd come up with an idea based on those statistics. And it worked blooming well for him. And, you know, and he always presents himself as this simple bloke, but actually there's a monster brain behind that works in that fashion. Whereas, you know, to go up to Freddie and to start talking stats to him, you'd get shooed away in a quick time. So I wouldn't do that. I'd go in very, very quickly and go, "This is what my view is. This is where you need to bowl it. What do you feel about that?" He'd go, "Yeah, that sounds good. Fantastic." And away he'd go. So I'd make it really, really concise. I'd make it as fun as possible. I wouldn't include any stats in it. I'd keep it to areas for his bowling, for example. And away he would go. So, you know, that there are some people that dig it. Get your idea of your team. I think as a coach, it's important to work out your individuals, because one coaching approach doesn't work with everybody. And it would be, I'd say, a very, very unique team that would have the same personality types going throughout it.
And the next question is in from Bathala Pali. He's asking, what kind of nutrition should a batsman require to carry out long games? Well, I know the answer to that, Bath. It's a lot of pies. But let's put that to our expert panel.
Now, I would say that question is a difficult one to answer straight off the bat, purely because it's a bit like saying, what kind of coaching should I have to become a good batsman? It's sort of it's quite a general question. And there's lots of ifs and maybes and what ifs and how about this and how about that and a variety of things. And especially in the world of nutrition, where there's as many different diets and regimes as there are gurus out there for that particular area. So there's lots of different pieces of advice that you can get. It's a very complicated question. I mean, general rules, I would say that you can't really go wrong with eating lots of fruit and veg, getting a sufficient amount of protein, and trying to control the amount of carbohydrates that you take in, especially if you feel like you're a little bit overweight. But that's not saying you should be on an Atkins-style zero-carb diet, or you know, go paleo, which is the modern trend at the moment. But you can't get a lot more complicated than that without going into more specifics. Do you ever give nutritional type advice, Gareth?
Not really. I think balance is crucial. Certainly my time in international cricket, diet was very, very important, but it didn't really steer away particularly from the things that in general life, which are important, that many of us adhere to and some of us don't always adhere to. So, you know, balance is crucial. Protein plays, in any sport, protein plays a big part because we are putting nutrition and rigor through our muscles on a regular basis, and we need to rebuild those. So, you know, protein does play a more significant part in sports than the general population would have. But what we did, we used to have a lot of vegetables around, a lot of fruits around, a lot of nuts to go alongside, you know, the chicken and the beef type things that would replace all of our protein that we required. So I think balance is massively important. And if you have a diet that is balanced, then it's going to do a lot of things. And then you can add little nuances on top, depending on your experiences that have come out of that. So, you know, looking at Steph, for example, we just talked about him and he's done an interview for us and he's doing loads of courses. Steph was hugely into this area because, as you'll see from his courses, he was monstrously into the weights, the different training methods, a long time before it became common practice. And as a result, because he was putting his body through so much rigor each week, more so than most of the other players, and in fact probably all of the other players that were around him, his intake of protein was different to theirs. You know, so he was always on the protein shakes and the protein bars, because he was then balancing his body up, you know, and the rigors he was putting with his body with his diet. So whereas that's probably more common practice now, because the training regimes have increased in their understanding, particularly around fast bowling, Steph was very much ahead of his time in that regard. And as a result, his nutritional background, which is part of the course, you know, is far more refined, I think, than my own.
I will recommend one more thing as well, which is, it's a system among many systems. It's not the perfect system, but it's certainly been effective in the people that I have recommended it to. And also myself, it's one that I follow. I've mentioned it on the show before, but it was a while ago. It's called Precision Nutrition. It's by a guy called Dr. John Berardi, who's a Canadian guy who has worked with a range of people right up to Olympic level athletes, but he's also worked with sort of, you know, people who just like to go to the gym and train as well. It's, you know, a broad range of people, and it is a system. It's a complete system. So if you follow it, you know that broadly it's going to give you the results that you're aiming for. Garrez is climbing up onto the soapbox this week. He gets 60 seconds to talk about anything he likes, as long as it's related to cricket, then he can't be interrupted. So, Garrez, your time starts now.
Well, I'm going to come out in defence of coaches a little bit this week. You know, we've all been watching New Zealand capitulate over in South Africa and looking as if their skill levels are way below the standard that they would expect and have produced over the years. But Mike Heston's taken an absolute battering in some of the press. He's a new coach, he's a young coach, hasn't got the first-class career that many others have had that have tried that job over in New Zealand and also haven't had a great time of things. But he's copping it at the moment for the lack of skill that's in their batting department. And one of the things that's changed in New Zealand cricket to me is that their unity and their sameness, you know, as a small country, was massively important. And since the IPL, they've almost been split up, really, because everybody's now playing as a cricketer looking at their own career rather than looking at the team goals. And with that in mind, I know that he's working solidly towards bringing that back together, and I think the press should lay off him a little bit.
That is the end of this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. Show number 195, Series 4, Episode 2. But before we go, we just have to decide on a winner for this week's prize, which is an online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. We had Sagar's question about statistical information and Beth Alapali's question about nutrition. So which one did you prefer, Gareth?
Great questions again. Beth Alapali's question I really liked, and fortunately, I'll be brutally honest here, it's not an area of my strength. I wasn't able to add a lot apart from the balance stuff. So you've exposed me there. So it's something that I can go away and work on. So thank you for that. I just thought that Sagar's question got us into not just about stats, but also about the preferences of people. And certainly the more I coach, the more I realise that I need to learn more about the people that I'm coaching rather than the things that I'm coaching. And it leads me to becoming hopefully a better coach by being able to apply my skills and my knowledge appropriately with each individual person. So I'm going to go with Sagar this week.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? You know, the idea that someone is a sort of a jug and all you need to do is pour the water of information into them, that doesn't really apply anymore. It's you need to understand how people understand before they can understand.
It's absolutely right, and the two guys that come up with some concepts that I'm working with and a number of other coaches around the UK are now working with talks about the player being the university and the coach being the student. And I think that's a really good way of looking at coaching, where, you know, because if we don't learn from the player and how they like things and what they're good at and where they want to go and all of these things, the softer skills of coaching, then how can we apply any of our knowledge and give them the chance of tapping into that knowledge? We have to learn about them rather than them having to learn about us.
Now, if somebody wanted to get in touch with the show and have their question answered, Gareth, what would they need to do?
Well, they could email us on coach@pitchvision.com, or equally, they could give us a call on 0208 816 7691.
They can. You can also, if you're listening, you can also get us on Twitter @PVCricketCoach. And you can find us on Facebook. We're Pitch Vision Academy. We're also on iTunes. If you want to head over there and do a search for Pitch Vision Academy, you can find us on the iTunes, subscribe to the show, listen every week, leave a review if you like what you hear. And if you don't want to subscribe using iTunes, there are other ways. Just head over to pitchvision.com/academy and click on the podcast link for details on how to do that. So that's all for this week. So until next time, when we hope to see burners again, we'll see you next week. Cheers, Gareth.
Cheers, mate. Well done.